hurry, hurry. You're not too late. You're just in time to hear the one and only recording done at the Father Fowl Gratitude Retreat in 2006. My name is Gavin Griffith, and I've done these retreats for 15 years. So the title of the CD is 15 Years with Gratitude. If someone hears this recording that was not on the retreat, Father Ralph Fowle conducted a retreat here at San Juan Bautista, St. Francis Retreat in California, 56 years ago. And he had about 20 men, and it's grown to 120 men 3 weekends in a row, so 360 men. And I will be retiring this year and look forward to just sitting and listening to someone else and visiting with the guys in between, dining with them, and attending their open meetings in the evening, something I've not been able to do because of a lack of energy the last few years of these retreats. What a blessing to be involved with this as a presenter for 15 years. I'd like to begin by saying, don't let anyone ever tell you, don't let anyone ever tell you that you're anything less than beautiful. Right before that line came from a beautiful recording entitled Songs for the Inner Child by Shana Noel. So let's listen to a little bit of this great recording artist.
How could anyone ever tell you were anything less than beautiful? How could anyone ever tell you were less than whole? How could anyone fail to notice that your loving is a miracle? Deeply you're connected to my soul.
I just got finished listening to this recording, and there are a couple of announcements that I want to get in here real quick, and they're out of order. The CD is called Songs for the Inner Child by Shana Noel, S-H-A-I-N-A, Noel, N-O-L-L. I'll always have copies of this, and you can get them from me. Area code 831-623-2828. 831-623-2828. A little while later on this recording, you're going to hear a good friend of mine, Richard Rohr. I want to give you his website. And the website is www.cacradicalgrace.org. CAC stands for Center for Action and Contemplation. So it's www.cacradicalgrace.org. Phone number for Richard, area code 505-247-1636. In listening to what I've already recorded, please don't listen to 20 minutes of this, more than 20 minutes at a time. The tape is just loaded, and I jump around, and I recorded a couple of things of Richard twice, but they're the important part. So you'll fry your brain if you listen to more than 20 minutes of this CD. God bless. Well, what a gift Shana gave to all of us to be able to recognize the truth that we're all made in beauty, even though we're men, and that all that macho stuff is a load of horse feathers. God created us beautifully. We see that at meetings. And on this particular recording, I'm going to say a lot of things I've never said on the retreat. Some personal things, some very personal things. Some beliefs that may not be conventional, but that are deeply heartfelt and held with a great deal of faith in my life. So I really look forward to doing this, and hang on. Let go of your old ideas. Keep an open mind. God bless you. If there's a secret to spiritual growth that's summarized beautifully in the acronym for the word HOW, H-O-W. A person who has honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And we could spend a lot of time meditating on each one of those words and cherishing them because they're true gifts and they're becoming less and less frequent in our society today. Oh, golly. We must be rid of our old ideas. That's what the book says. I think a number of people do that, but they never open their mind to new ideas. So they have less and less of their old ideas, and that's all they repeat is the few that they have left. I'm sure you've all seen this in other people. Whether we realize it or not, we're not in the judgment business, but we're in the learning and growth business. Judgment means that you make a moral decision about the rightness or wrongness or holiness or awfulness of another person's ideas or behavior. And judgment belongs to our higher power, or at least I believe that. You've often heard me say that spirituality is waking up. That's what 12-step recovery is, having had a spiritual awakening. We wake up to the spiritual. A good author, Anthony DeMello, and I was going to attend a workshop of his and he died too early. He was a Jesuit from India. And my favorite little story that he tells is about a guy who parachuted out of an airplane. And he was so happy because the chute opened, but he got hung up in a tree. And he didn't have enough upper body strength to pull himself up the harness to get to the branches where he was hung up. And it was too far to let go. And he knew he would have broken something because of the height. So he knew he needed help. But sure enough, somebody came along and the guy in the parachute is yelling, "Help me, help me, help me." And the guy says, "Oh, okay, I'll help you." And the guy in the parachute says, "Where am I?" And the guy on the ground says, "You're up in a tree." And the guy hanging onto the harness says, "You must be a priest." "Well, as a matter of fact, I am." "What makes you think I'm a priest?" "Because what you just said is certainly true, but equally useless information." I love telling stories on priests because we try to represent God, and we're human, and we have all kinds of faults and failures, and we make a lot of mistakes, and other people know that. And when we have our ideal life as becoming perfect or becoming an ideal man or woman, or priest, we're always going to fall short, so we always have something to beat ourselves up with. And if you're an alcoholic, our disease tries to help us beat ourselves up. And the perfectionist who's an alcoholic is doomed to unhappiness forever. Anyway, old ideas. What are old ideas? Old ideas are ideas that worked at one time for us but no longer work, or they don't fit this situation. Or maybe they're ideas that never worked and we just woke up to that fact. We must be rid of our old ideas, and if we're open-minded and involved in embracing growth, we're going to have new ideas. And I beg you to be open to that. And when you hear me repeating my same old ideas over and over, and they become less and less in number because I discard the old ones that stunt my own growth. Wake me up, will you? So, here's some new ideas. This is Richard Rohr, a good friend of mine. And he presents some ideas that are, I think, revolutionary. And they're coming from a priest, a Franciscan priest, Richard Rohr. Belongs to the same order that I do. He lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And he's a great author. I'll give you some more information about Richard later. But he's going to say some things that probably you haven't heard before. At least I haven't. So I avoid scripture on the retreats, but you're going to get some now, and it's going to make you, think. And whether you happen to be a Christian or not, you can understand and respect the scripture. And I'm sure you'll understand Richard's interpretation of it because it applies directly to us as a group of recovering men.
This is Luke's account of the healing of the Gerasene demoniac. The first part. We'll be reading it in parts through this whole conference. Then they sailed to the territory of Gerasene, which is opposite Galilee. When he came ashore, a man from the town who was possessed by demons met him. For a long time, he had not worn any clothes. He did not live in a house, but he lived among the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out, and he fell down before him. In a loud voice, he shouted, "What have you to do with me, Jesus? I beg you, do not torment me." For Jesus had already ordered the unclean spirit to come out of the man. It had taken hold of him many times, and he was bound with chains and shackles as a result. But he would break his bonds, and he would be driven by the demon into deserted places. Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "Legion," because he represented many demons. And they pleaded with him not to order them to depart into the abyss. As you'll see, we're going to use that gospel. We're going to build on that gospel this entire conference. And before we give even any welcoming or introductory remarks, we wanted to simply make that statement. I'm going to move right on it. And then we'll make our welcome and our introductory remarks afterwards. Perhaps it surprises some of you that we would begin, maybe it doesn't surprise you at all, with an account of an exorcism. I think modern, postmodern people were actually somewhat embarrassed by how much of Jesus' ministry is driving out devils. And we all know they don't exist, and we're sort of embarrassed by the thought, and so why do we have to read these silly, useless accounts? And the fact that they are so common in the Gospels perhaps should give us room for pause to wonder what it is that these are really referring to. And I'm sure you're already making the connections, because I am convinced that the driving out of the devil was an early, very straightforward metaphor and symbol and reality for the dealing with what we now call addiction.
This chart is taken from a 4-CD set, and I'm going to jump around a whole lot and give you just little glimpses of different things. Richard admits that he's not in a 12-step program. In a way, he kind of regrets that. But it's not that he doesn't have addictions, but he's sure he has many, but doesn't qualify for any of the programs that we know. He gives a remarkable story about how he learned about Alcoholics Anonymous and has a feel toward 12-step recovery. So there's going to be some gaps in thought here, but the pieces I've selected is certainly going to get you thinking, give you some new ideas.
I am convinced exorcism and the speaking of devils was a primitive but absolutely truthful way of referring to what we now call addiction. In each case, notice, the devil possesses the person. It's not something they seem to have chosen or have much freedom about. It happens to them. And yet it took us centuries to understand that addiction is a disease. Much of history, even after these Gospels, still tended to think of addicted people as somehow morally culpable, morally unworthy, inferior human beings. And here already, by the naming of it as something that possessed you, we're trying to separate from this notion of moral culpability. It's something done to you more than something you do, although then, of course, you do it too. It is a force larger than the person, which they personify as a devil or Satan. They are, in some sense, in every case, those possessed by a demon are in some case, some way, paralyzed. Or, to use the 12-step language, powerless to do anything about it. They are trapped.
Now you know my friend Richard. It gets better. I thought I'd give you a little break. At this point, you all know, those of you who've been with me before, that I have great affection for mystery. There used to be a radio program called I Love a Mystery with Jack Dock and Redney. I think Redney was the Englishman. He talked funny. Anyway, we all love mysteries, and yet we're driven by data and logic today. And the false impression that men can do anything if they read the right How to Do It book. However, just look at your own history and you'll realize that you've had all kinds of failures and all kinds of problems. It's called life. In a little while, I'll get into some of the problems or the bumps in the road in my life, or some of the, in a Christian context, crosses I've had to bear. Yours may be different, but you have them, and it's good to acknowledge them, because it helps us with the powerlessness and the unmanageability, which is reality and the basis of our whole recovery.
I am convinced exorcism and the speaking of devils was a primitive but absolutely truthful way of referring to what we now call addiction. In each case, notice, the devil possesses the person. It's not something they seem to have chosen or have much freedom about. It happens to them. And yet it took us centuries to understand that addiction is a disease. Much of history, even after these Gospels, still tended to think of addicted people as somehow morally culpable, morally unworthy, inferior human beings. Here already, by the naming of it as something that possessed you, we're trying to separate from this notion of moral culpability. It's something done to you more than something you do, although then, of course, you do it too. It is a force larger than the person, which they personify as a devil or Satan. They are, in some sense, in every case, those possessed by a demon are, in some case, some way, paralyzed. Or, to use the 12-step language, powerless to do anything about it. They are trapped. Well, basically, just because we don't know how to read sacred story, we don't know how to read sacred mythology. And the scientific mind emerged and said this was all ridiculous. And yet I think we're going to see the metaphors are all correct. As more and more scientists are even discovering, the intuitions of religion are usually right on. The formulations of those intuitions are very often overly literal. They become cliches. They become dogmas and doctrines that people mouth quickly, without any understanding of the underpinnings or what they really mean, and we end up with dead religion, where simply people believe phraseologies and lose the power, which is exactly what I think of 2 Timothy prophesied, that religion would keep up all the forms, but the inner power would be lost. One reason I wanted to again talk about this theme is because I believe the 12-step program, more than almost any other programmatic attempt at spiritual renewal, has rediscovered power, actual transformative power. I gave a conference last year called From Information to Transformation, where we were trying to recognize that much of religion has become the transferring of information, as if information can save you, just to have correct information. Just to have information that Rome approves of and this is going to transform you, right? I don't think so. There's little evidence that that's true, and Paul takes much of his letter to the Romans to make that very clear. And yet, we go right back into it. We can do it by intelligence or willpower. The 12-step programs have rediscovered, which I think is authentic gospel, is that it has little to do with intelligence. Surprise to Western educated people. And it has little to do with willpower. Addiction, as I'm going to talk about it here. And I do want to say at the beginning that my attempt to talk about it is from a very limited, I hope helpful, focus. I'm not an expert in the field at all. I'm sure I have plenty of addictions. I'm not, sorry to say, a member of a formal 12-step program. Never have been. But when I first moved to Albuquerque almost 20 years ago, I lived downtown, and they met right behind my little house. And they were gathering outside my door almost every other evening, so we got to be friends. And they say, you can come in. And I felt very privileged. It was like being invited into a sacred sanctuary of people who weren't afraid to admit they were sinners. Huh? You know, church gatherings aren't like that. Huh? You have tests to get into a church. But here, this was a marvelous new kind of church, where there was no entrance requirement of worthiness. In fact, exactly the opposite. They all agreed outside the door that they were miserably unworthy. Huh? And they generously invited me to join this club of unworthiness. Huh? And this is back in the late 80s. And I remember leaving those meetings, just walking to my little house right next door, and feeling time after time, I just attended a most extraordinary church service. And there were no priest's investments, and there were no candles, and there were no golden vessels. But it sure felt like church. That the only real necessity to understand was to have done somehow, by hook or crook, the first step. If you've done the first step, if grace and God have been able to lead you to a place where you admit you're powerless, I think you've earned the right to talk. Until that point, you have nothing to say. Right? Until that point, you have nothing to say. Right? And I think spirituality has even begun. It's all information. It's all chatter. It's all dogma and doctrine. It's not yet power. Until, ironically and paradoxically, you go through the place of powerlessness. Isn't it amazing? But basically, I'm going to describe addiction in this way. And it's not the only way, maybe not the best way, but it's my one approach these days. I'm going to call it the using up of desire, especially spiritual desire. But we want to examine these days how it is that we use up our spiritual desire. I am convinced that many addicts I've met in my life are actually, strange as it might seem, although to some of you it won't be strange at all, are actually more spiritually inclined people than many people I meet in the typical church or parish. Sometimes I'm amazed at the lack of spiritual curiosity in our typical Catholic parish. It's like, let's just get this over. I'm not interested in anything beyond going through the motions. In fact, there even seems to be a resistance to making anything meaningful, which is a sign of addicted religion, anyway. That addiction never wants to go to depth. It always wants to keep it superficial. I'm going to be reading a bit either this afternoon or this evening from Bill's story in the first part of the big book. I'm sure many of you have read it. I consider it in just a short chapter to be a real religious masterpiece. It's theologically correct. It's psychologically brilliant. It's well written. He must have been a smart man, this Bill Wilson. But it's most of all truthful. It describes the depths of despair that he got to with his drinking, that describes without any apology his return to sanity, as he called it. And after a while, it passes for sanity. Of course, you need better and better blouses, I guess, and more blouses, because you experience each time that emptiness afterwards when you know it is not the real thing. To use theological language, and I'll be jumping back and forth, we choose false gods instead of the one God that we really intuit and long for. And we all do it. In the Hebrew Scriptures, there's really only originally one meaning to sin. The only meaning of sin is idolatry. Worshipping something that is God is not God. That's all.
Well, maybe that's a lot all at once, but we'll just have a little bit more of Richard, and then we'll go on to something else. But I am so moved with the ability of this man to communicate things that I recognize as the truth. There's a theory among educators that educators don't teach other than providing some data or information. But when it comes to wisdom, we all have, and this is a stretch, but stay with me, we all have wisdom within us, but it's never been tapped or activated until someone speaks that wisdom or tells that story that is saving and transforming, like your story is, or others. I lost my train of thought. I'm not going to try to fix it, but you know where I was headed. So just a little bit more of Richard.
If you built church, and a lot of us have, on a meritocracy, a system of rewards and punishments, a system of worthiness contests, which I have to admit, I think most mainline churches still are. Until you've experienced the first step, you don't understand. You can't understand until you've gone what Jesus would call the way of the cross, the descent journey, we call it in men's work, until you've gone to the place of powerlessness, but the journey has not even begun.
What journey is he talking about? He's talking about the spiritual journey. And most people don't understand this. They'd understand it if they heard it and could identify with some experience of having been broken. The cliche in Christianity is until they accept their cross. Cross is suffering. Cross is an idea that crosses our old ideas that has the power to help us realize that our old way of thinking, our old way of seeing needs to give way to a new truth. And you've had that experience many times. So have I. So isn't it paradoxically wonderful? A paradox is something that works backwards, that looks like it wouldn't work. And yet it does. Our problem is lack of power, but until we admit our lack of power, we have no access to the power that comes from God. So the way of suffering, let me say it a different way. The way of being surprised that our old ideas are false seems insane to most of our teenage ways of looking at things. Richard develops a metaphor. He talks about the fact that we need to find a new way of breathing. By the way, spirit and breath in many languages are the same. So we can talk about Holy Spirit, we can talk about Holy Breath. We need a new way of breathing. And Richard refers to that as breathing underwater. We have to learn how to breathe underwater. I can't explain it any more than that at this time, but Richard is eloquent. So if you have his CDs, you'll be, don't miss it because it's kind of subtle, but that's where he came up with a talk called Breathing Underwater, which is all about addiction. And that's no longer available, but the CDs of the set of four CDs that you're listening to now, were inspired by that concept of learning to breathe in a new way. So every time we are rid of an old idea, that just slaps our ego in the face. It's like our ego has been hit head on by a truck, and we go into shock. Let me give you some simple examples in my life as a man child growing up. When I was young, I was fascinated with mechanical things. All of my first toys were tools of one kind or another. I learned how to read blueprints before I could read words. And my dad brought a bunch of blueprints home from a job he was supervising and gave them to me. They were my treasure. And I remember a couple came over with their young boy my age, and I showed him my treasure, these blueprints. And I went into the other room for some reason. When I came back, he'd made paper airplanes out of my treasures. And I grabbed him and was about to beat him up until the adults intervened. So I had to let go of the idea that blueprints are less than the whole world, less than my temporary addiction to something that I thought was so fulfilling and wonderful that I really didn't need any new toy. But I had a lot of new toys as I grew up. I used to haunt hardware stores, and until recently I collected tools as art objects, as friends, as things of beauty. And let's face it, tools are tools, and some of them are beautiful. But to worship a tool rather than having a need to use it and to go ahead and use it is foolishness. So that was a shock, a terrible shock. I really predate color television, but I remember as a kid when that came along, I saw a magician on TV, and I wanted to grow up and be a magician. And I bought a little magic set, and I started putting on shows. One of my all-time thrills was to take a table lamp, put it in a cardboard container, and make it disappear. And it appeared in another container across our living room. My mother was totally, totally taken in, and she was just awestruck and so happy to have been the mother of this wonder child. Anyway, you get the drift. It's all about you. From magic, I went on to admiring people who could weld. And for some reason, I ran across a lot of welders. I found an ad in the back of Popular Mechanics. I think Popular Science is a more popular magazine today, but in my day, Popular Mechanics was had a bigger subscription base than Popular Science. Anyway, there was an ad in the back where you could send away and buy a prop pitch motor for a B-29 through Army Surplus for $30. I think the freight was about $30. And came with plans to convert it into an arc welder. So I got that. I followed the plans exactly, and it never worked. I was crushed. But I continued to watch people weld. One day when I was watching a welder, he got a phone call and had to leave. So I quickly grabbed the ground clamp, hooked it up to a piece of scrap, put the hood on my head, and was getting ready to strike an arc. And I flipped my head forward, and the hood came crashing down the way that I'd watched it happen many times with my friend. And I was a hotshot teenager at that time, and I was smoking. And when the hood came down, it smashed the cigarette into my cheek and burnt my cheek, blistered my cheek. But I thought I'd electrocuted myself. And, of course, I stuck the rod instead of striking an arch. And the generator, started howling. It does that every time you stick a welding rod. And just then the welder came around the corner. I think he's still laughing. What is all this about? It's about growing up. It's about making mistakes. If you're alive, you're going to make mistakes. There's a wonderful Chinese saying, 10 times down, 11 times up. growth is getting up again. Being willing to take another 10 mistakes before you get up one more time. To say it another way, life is all about hanging on and letting go of ideas, hanging on to what works. Just a couple more examples. Why am I doing all of this? I'm doing this because the original step of the 12 steps was ego deflation at depth. Ego deflation at depth. What's ego? That's that part of us that is grandiose and insists on being self-sufficient, needing no one, not even God. The whole program is a counter or an antidote to this wild ego, which never sleeps and it never goes away. But hopefully we overlay a spirituality based on an acknowledgement of our powerlessness, based on an acknowledgement that we're going to have to carry our crosses, that's Christian talk, and allow Christ to redeem our mistakes. Moving along, about this time I had a passion for climbing telephone poles. Of course, you need a pair of climbing spikes and a safety belt. And lo and behold, at a swap fest, I found a pair of climbing spikes, of all things, for 75 cents, and I bought them. And I went home and I strapped those on my leg and I jury-rigged a safety belt and I started climbing the telephone pole that supported my basketball backstop. And I got about 2 feet off the ground. I was so proud of myself and I leaned back into that safety belt and I was smoking and I rested there and was pridefully puffing away on a cigarette at my great accomplishment. I was only about 2 feet off the ground. Thank God. Because I soon got tired of that position, so I pulled myself into the telephone pole, and I thought I was going to be able to rest that way. But what I did was pull the climbing spikes out of the telephone pole, and I slid down the pole with my tippy toes on the ground, thank God. But I had splinters all up and down my belly and on the inside of my legs. Another painful learning experience. Four times in my life I've escaped death. Falling off a mountain one day, trying to rescue a handkerchief that had blown away in the wind. Being stabbed by going on a 12-step call by myself, and the person wasn't ready for the program yet, but scratched me up a little bit with his knife because he was trying to show how tough he was. A car accident. Probably alcohol related, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure. And then the fire that took place at St. Francis Retreat. 6 of us were asleep in that building while it was burning. Probably the most damaging character defect I had was being a good little boy. Now, you think that would be wonderful, but as a kid I found out that that was a way for me to get my way. It was a way for me to please the adults. So I tried to become this good little boy, but when you keep making mistakes, which is what kids do, it's what men do too, and of course women, you guys know all about that. Anyhow, and you think you have to be perfect and this good little boy, and yet you keep making mistakes, and if you grew up with the spiritual abuse that I did, where everything that was a mistake was thought of as sinful, so I thought I was this awful, terrible creature. And I have this front, I have this double life on the outside. I have to look like I'm such a good little boy. I became an altar boy. Oh, the old ladies just love the fact that I was such a good little altar boy. I grew up and became a good little priest. That nearly killed me, and I'm sure it didn't help anybody else. But it was a trap, and that's a hard one to get rid of. And every now and then I switch back into the good little boy to get my way and manipulate people and to con them. Are you beginning to relate this to your story? I hope so. 2 other things that I had to change my mind about was we had a great prejudice in our family against alcoholics. And when I told my parents I wanted to go to the seminary, a little private meeting, and then they announced to me that they'd support me in whatever I decided to do. And that they were pleased that I wanted to be a priest, and if that didn't work out, they'd still love me and support me. But, son, promise us if you decide to be a priest that you won't drink alcohol. Well, I went into shock. What's alcohol got to do with priesthood? Well, what it had to do with priesthood is my parents lived in this small town in New York State where the pastor was an active alcoholic. He never got any help, but he tore up and scandalized that town for 18 or 20 years. And my folks didn't want me to be like that. I love my folks, and it sounded like a sensible request, although I didn't understand it. So I promised. And you know what that did for me? When I discovered alcohol in the seminary, we had wine on major feasts, and I always cleaned up the tables afterwards. I didn't do that regularly, but when we had wine, I did. And I took care of all the leftover wine. Since I was on the maintenance crew, and by the way, I did teach myself to weld. That kept me out of the gardens for 4 years of philosophy and 4 years of theology. Plants and I just don't get along that well. Some of you have green thumbs. I don't. Anyway, by that time, I was on the maintenance crew and had learned how to weld and did a lot of pretty good welding. But that's a learning process, too. You burn a lot of holes in your clothes, and when you try to do overhead welding, that's a learning experience in itself. Anyway, one of the plumbers that was helping me one day gave me a bottle of Chivas Regal, I think you say, scotch. Oh, I had a new higher power. Oh, it was wonderful. But every time I drank, I did it with enormous guilt because I'd broken my promise to my parents. In spite of all that guilt and shame, it helped me hit bottom quicker than I would have otherwise. Guilt isn't all that bad. Neither is shame. They can be great motivators, but don't stop there. Go beyond it to forgiveness and experiencing God's grace working in the messy, complicated, and unmanageable parts of our life. You see, all I'm talking about is getting you back to step one again and again and again, because that's the basis of the whole program. The original step one in the six-step program that preceded the 12 steps was ego deflation at depth. Ego deflation at depth. What is ego? Ego is that cocky, arrogant part of ourselves that wants to be self-sufficient and that makes everything revolve around us. And it never sleeps and it never goes away, but we can tone it down and override it by program. But the program constantly teaches us humility, which is basically truth-telling about our incompleteness, our unmanageability, our humanity. Some really wonderful person said we're not human beings trying to become spiritual, we're spiritual beings trying to learn to be human. Learning to be human is to deal with humanity and our flawed nature and all those mistakes and bumps in the road. I have a dear friend, his name's Stephen. Stephen lives in Florida now, so I haven't seen him in a long time. However, Stephen prays every day, thanking God for his powerlessness and his unmanageability. I'm not there yet, but Stephen is, and I admire him, and I know he's right. So, another awful thing in my life was a learning disability called attention deficit disorder. It was only about 10 years ago that I found out what that was, and I've taken several computer tests, and I flunk all of them that proves that I do have attention deficit disorder. Basically, it's a lazy frontal lobe that can be treated with stimulants, but as an addict, I can't take stimulants, and besides that, I have rheumatic fever, and stimulants don't go too well with that. So I can't do the chemical solution, but I've learned a lot of tricks, but it's still a pain in the butt. For those of you who have been to conferences with me, you may recognize the fact that in each one I have two, usually three, major points that I want to make. But I don't know, and I make those, but I don't know where I'm going in between. God can redeem our character defects. Many people have I'm so embarrassed about that. But a lot of people tell me, boy, you keep our attention because we don't know what you're going to say next. Neither do I. I don't know what I'm going to say next half the time because my mind just jumps from one thing to another. It's as if I'm watching a TV screen that somebody else has the remote, and I don't catch the transitions. I'm just into that new picture. that new soundbite, whatever it is. If I were to try to say the Lord's Prayer and think of the meaning of the words, it would take me 10 minutes before I could complete that, because I'd have to start over again and again and again and again, because I'm so distracted. Our Father who art in heaven. Oh, it's hot today. I better remember where I put that fan. Oh, I'm supposed to do something important today. What was it? I know I was worried about it last night. You know, I lost the Lord's Prayer way back there somewhere. It's a pain in the butt, guys. But I have that, and I've learned some tricks. I've been to a learning center. I'm not cured by a long shot, but it keeps me humble. That's a character defect that in some areas of my life has been redeemed. It's been redeemed because I don't fight it any longer. I don't beat myself up because of it. And God uses it to keep people's attention sometimes. The most recent and big bump in our lives is the fire at St. Francis Retreat in San Juan Bautista. 6 of us were asleep in the building while it was burning. And I used to ride with the arson squad a little bit in Phoenix, and I know enough about fires to know that most people who are asleep in a fire never wake up. They're overcome by the fumes. They don't even experience being burned. Thank God for smoke detectors. We're all alive. We're all safe. We lost a beautiful building and, oh, so many wonderful memories. But we're alive. And life has a whole new meaning. After the fire, I got some grief counseling. I knew I was in shock. And thank God that worked out well. Let me use that as an example of how God often works. How God often works in my life. 2 weeks after the fire, Sister B, who's in recovery, was conducting a retreat for recovering alcoholics at our retreat house in Danville, San Damiano Retreat, Danville, California. B is one of my 2 most favorite retreat presenters for 12-step people. I'd love to see her do a retreat for you guys someday, but that might be too big a jump for you. You're probably not humble enough to sit at the feet of a wise lady, let alone a nun. Anyway, I'm poking fun of you right now. And isn't that wonderful? We can poke fun at each other. There's a healing in humor, the kind of humor we have at Around Program. I talked a non-recovering person into going to an AA meeting, and after it was over, I said, well, what'd you think of it? And she said, well, I didn't think much of it. I said, what do you mean? Well, they told horror stories. And they laughed. Well, that happened. Thank God we could laugh. A whole lot more happened, but my friend didn't catch on to that. But you know what I'm talking about. Am I repeating myself? I hope I am. I want to drive home to each of you and to myself that you and I continually make mistakes. You and I continually run head to head spiritually with our ego that wants to run everything and play God and never make mistakes. Well, lots of luck. Ego easing God out. A lot of you know that I wanted to be an atheist at one time, and I screwed that up, thank God. But my real problem was not that I didn't believe in God. I just wanted his job. So life is a journey, and there are a lot of bumps in the road along the journey. But expect them. This is a real stretch. Celebrate them. Because you can travel lighter once you get rid of the clutter. Old ideas are heavy. And pretending that something is true when it isn't takes enormous energy. One of the greatest things I learned in life was from a psychologist. He said, people who argue with the truth get sick. I owe that man a great debt. His first name was Jared. and he was in Phoenix, and he had a wonderful practice, and I sent a lot of people to him, and they got better. I knew he was real good. This was at a time when I didn't know I was an alcoholic, but I was convinced I was crazy, and it was the most humiliating thing I ever did was to tell him about my insanity. And at the fourth session, I'm going to give two examples of what I think is acceptance. Acceptance, a popular topic with us. In that fourth session, I just blurted out, because I knew he was good at diagnosis, "Jerry, please tell me what's wrong with you." He said, "I can't tell you." Wow. I knew there was something wrong with me, but I didn't know it was so weird. I didn't have a name. Didn't even have a name. I can't help you. I don't know what's wrong with you. And I don't know anybody who can help you. So now it's hopeless. Oh, the ego is struggling in great pain with the idea that I'm terminally weird, and it can't be fixed. And then he added something that was even more devastating to the ego. He said, "I don't know what's wrong with you, and I don't know anybody who can figure it out or help you. Try this on for size, until you quit drinking. And I don't know anything about that. Find someone who can help you with that, and then come back and we'll figure out what kind of a nut you are." Oh, I was so angry. I was so devastated. I trusted this man with my deepest, darkest secrets, and he wanted me to quit drinking. That was my medicine. That was the only hope of sanity, in quotation marks, that I had. It was a terrible day. I remember driving home. I parked by the side of the road, cranked up the air conditioning and the fan as high as they would go, and stuck my head in front of the vent because I thought I was going to faint at the mere thought of not drinking. That man had married a beautiful woman. I think they had 8 children. A wonderful kid. His wife, her name was Simone. Simone was an alcoholic, and Jerry tried for 20 or 30 years to help her with her alcoholism. Of course, he applied a logical approach to it that had no effect whatsoever except creating more havoc in the home. And by the time I came along, he knew he couldn't help alcoholics, and he was professional enough to tell me that. And he also was smart enough not to suggest AA, because he knew how angry I was. And if he suggested AA, I probably would have never tried AA. What a gift he gave me. I eventually chased him down in California several years later and made my amends to him, because I called up everyone I'd referred to him and said, "I don't think Jerry's as good as I thought he was. I'm aware of some unprofessionalism in his practice. So you better not continue with him. Find somebody else." You know what the unprofessionalism was? He told me to quit drinking. Well, this good little boy is not vindictive. But this alcoholic is. And so are you. I truly believe that if you're an alcoholic and haven't contemplated murder, you're misdiagnosed. The other great piece of acceptance that Gary J. gave me was that saying, "People who argue with the truth get sick." So there's a great inventory question. How am I arguing with the truth? How am I arguing with the truth? Ask the question sincerely, and the answer will come. You may not be thrilled with it, but you'll be able to accept it as the truth. That's what we deal with in recovery, the truth. The truth is the perfect antidote to denial. By the way, I don't know if you guys know this yet, but if you miss meetings, it's a misdemeanor. The more you miss, the meaner you get. Me too. Isn't recovery fun? Well, the fire did two wonderful things. My priorities did an automatic sort. All at once I knew what was important and wasn't, what wasn't important. And you know how I've struggled over the years maintaining mailing lists and being organized. I probably had 30 big boxes in the basement full of paperwork, and I didn't know what was in any of those boxes. So now, for the first time in my life, I'm organized. I have nothing to organize. What a blessing. So, 2 weeks after the fire, I wanted to make a retreat with Sister B. It was terrific. It was wonderful. And by that time, I knew I was in shock. I knew the symptoms. My brain would just kind of go away. I mean, not in an ADD or distracted way, but it just wouldn't work. And there was a nun on the retreat who was a good counselor, so I asked her if she had ever done any grief counseling, and she was honest enough to say, no, I'm not good at that. I've read about it, but I'm not good at it. So I thanked her for the truth, and we all had a name tag with our first name on it. And this one woman had a name tag that said Dr. K, D-R period, K-A-Y. So when I saw that, I said, what kind of a doctor are you? And she got all upset and said, oh, I'm so embarrassed. Nobody else has a title, and they gave me a title. I said, that's not what I'm asking. I want to know what kind of a doctor you are. She said, well, I'm a psychologist. I said, do you know anything about grief counseling? She said, well, I've written articles on it. I teach a class on it. Isn't that amazing? Thank God someone put DR period on her name tag. Oh, I spent an hour with her on the retreat and a half hour a little later on the retreat. She really got me on the right track and sent me a lot of wonderful material on grief and healing. God blesses me all the time. He blesses you too. You're probably unaware of it because you're so busy singing a variation of your favorite theme song. Me, 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 me. And then you go to a meeting and you forget that for a while and you hear the other wonderful chorus, we. It's a we program. You can't do it for me, but I can't do it by myself. Isn't it interesting? We means yes in French. Yes, yes, yes. That's our new theme. Saying yes to life. Saying yes to the defects. Saying yes to the mistakes. Saying yes to the grace in our life. And having affection for growing spiritually. Let me use the church word. I might embarrass you. Growing in holiness. You ever thought of yourself as holy? I think you are. I know you are. Well, you've met my friend Richard Rohr, and you've heard a little things of some things about my story and the bumps in the road and how the bumps in the road become blessed bumps. We all have warts, but they're beautiful warts. I think you get the idea. I hope I can remember it. So, one of my favorite stories is a Native American story, and I'm going to record it now because it means so much to me, and some of you have heard it many times, but as you hear it again, you'll have some new ideas. I do every time I tell it. I hope that you learn the story and can share it with others, particularly loved ones or those who are really hurting, or children. Tell them that the story is a Native American healing story. Actually, it's about the journey we call life. And it's about stretching, and you don't need to tell them all of that. Tell them there are some animals that show up in the story, and don't try to figure out the meaning of the story, because there's a lot of meanings, and they're all true. It's an experience. It's a story that is alive. Every time I hear this story, every time I have the privilege of sharing it with someone, it's different. So just enjoy it. Tell the people to relax. Once there was a mouse, a little mouse. In fact, that was his name. He was a runt. He was smaller than all the other mice. And because he was small and different, he was looked down on. He was shunned. He never got chosen to be on a committee, let alone a GSR. When they chose upsides for games, he would never be chosen. Or if he was, he was chosen last. He was the outcast in the family, the nonconformist, the one who was different. For no apparent reason, one day he decided to go away from the world of mice. Mice don't do that. When you see a mouse, there's another one nearby, but he went by himself. Sometimes we have companions on the journey, but the real journey is one we take by ourselves. Then he rested, and he heard a noise, a ringing in his ears. He thought he needed to clean his ears out, so he did that, but he still heard it, didn't know what it was, went back to the world of mice, forgot all about it. On another day, he went further away. This is courageous stuff. And when he got quiet, he heard the noise again. It was louder. And on the third day, he went further away, and even before he quieted down, he heard the noise. It was loud. Went back to the world of mice and tried to share this information with another mouse, and the other mouse said, I don't want to hear about it. I don't hear any noise. And don't let anybody know that we've been talking. You're touched in the head, and I don't want to be associated with you. You're weird. Oh, thought little mouse. On another day, he went further away than before, and he got quiet, and he heard the noise, but then he heard another noise. It was a voice, and it said, hello, little brother. And little mouse turned around and was staring into the eyes of a huge, beautiful raccoon. Kind of jumped back, but the raccoon said, oh, don't let your fear or anger blind you. I won't hurt you. What are you doing out here? Well, I heard a noise, and I'm investigating. That noise, said the raccoon. Yes, you hear it too. Well, of course. What is it? That, my little friend, is the river. The river? What's a river? Oh, it's a thing of beauty. I'm the guide to the sacred river. Follow me. I'll take you there. So now little mouse is following this huge, beautiful animal who could kill him with one swipe of its mighty paw. But he made a new friend, someone who accepted him and his smallness and his uncertainty and his lostness. And they get to the river, and it's rushing and tumbling and roaring, and the raccoon motions to the little mouse to go downstream with him. And they get to where it's clear and calm, so clear. So calm that he can see the mountains and the evergreens reflected in the water. And it's quiet. Oh, it's quiet. And the raccoon spoke again. It's a great thing, the river. All of life is carried on. Oh, it's a thing of beauty, said little mouse. Hello, little brother, said another voice. Hello, said little mouse, and he looked down, and there was this big, green, ugly frog sitting on a lily pad on the edge of the river. Little mouse jumped back in fright, and the frog said, oh, don't let your fear or anger blind you. I won't hurt you. If you're a friend of Brother Raccoon, you're a friend of mine. What are you doing out here? Well, I heard a noise, and Brother Raccoon told me it was the river, and he showed it to me. And now I've met you. Would you like some medicine power? Asked the frog. Medicine power for me? Said little mouse. Yes, I would. Then crouch as low as you can, and jump as high as you can, and when you do, you will have medicine power. So little mouse crouched as low as he could, and he jumped, and he jumped higher than he thought he could jump, and he fell back down. But not to earth. He fell in the river, and he'd never been underwater before, and he's threshing around, and he's swallowing part of the river, and that's an awful thing, because he always was able to breathe, and now it was so difficult. And just when he thought he was going to die, he bobbed to the surface, and he is threshing around, and he sees a tree branch that's in the water, and he He grabs that branch and pulls himself ashore and shakes the water off him, and he screams at the frog, "You tricked me! You tricked me!" "Oh, don't let your fear or anger blind you," said the frog. "You're just wet. What happened when you jumped?" "Oh, I saw the sacred mountain." "You saw the sacred mountains?" "Yes. You are a great mouse if you saw the sacred mountains. And you have a new name. From now on you will be known as Jumping Mouse." "Jumping Mouse," thought Little Mouse. "Hot stuff." "No, no. Jumping Mouse," thought Jumping Mouse. He was no longer Little Mouse. He was Jumping Mouse. "Oh, I have to go back and tell my people all about this." "Ha, ha, ha," said the frog and the raccoon in unison. "What is so funny?" "Well, you can go back and tell them if you want, but they don't want to hear. Even if they do hear, they won't be able to understand." "Oh, but I must." "Don't forget, don't let your fear or anger blind you." And Jumping Mouse left and went back to the world of mice. And it was the first time that the other mice had missed him. The very first time. And the scouts who were on alert saw him coming at a distance, so they called an emergency group conscience, and the GSO announced to Jumping Mouse that he could not return to the world of mice. He'd been wet, it had not been raining. Some large animal had probably wanted to eat him and found him poisonous. "We always knew you were weird. You're banned from here." Oh, Jumping Mouse went into shock. He can always go home. But he was thrown out of home. He was thrown out of the house. He was thrown out of the familiar lifestyle he knew. He wasn't thrilled with it, but at least he knew it. What to do? He just wandered around by himself for a while. And then he remembered the sacred mountains, and he knew he'd never make it there, but he thought he'd head in that direction. So he starts for the sacred mountains. He has to stop and rest every now and then, and one time when he did, he looked up and he saw spots moving in the sky. Spots. He didn't know what they were. Mice don't see good at a distance. But he'd heard about mice and eagles. "Oh, don't tell me they're eagles." Well, just to play it safe, he went from one hiding spot to another. And one time when he stopped to rest, he heard heavy breathing, heavy labored breathing. And he investigated and found a huge mound of brown hair slowly rising and falling with the breath. And in the middle of that mound of brown hair was a couple of pus-filled eyes. And outside of the eyes, a couple of horns, buffalo horns. And the buffalo didn't look at all well. Jumping Mouse made some motions, but the buffalo didn't see him. "Hello, my brother," said Jumping Mouse. "Hello," said the buffalo. "Whoever you are." "What are you doing?" asked Jumping Mouse. "I'm sick, and I'm dying. And my little friend, whoever you are, only the eye of a mouse will cure me." "One of my eyes? One of my tiny eyes cure such a great beast?" "Oh." Jumping Mouse got very quiet. And then he knew what he was going to do. Stood right in front of that buffalo who couldn't see him, and he said, "Brother Buffalo, I am a mouse, and if it will cure you, you may have one of my eyes." And no sooner had he said that than his eye flew out of his head into the buffalo, and the buffalo became whole and stood up and began walking around. Then he remembered his little friend. "Oh, thank you for restoring me to health. What are you doing out here?" "Well, I've seen the sacred mountains, and I want to go there." Good, said the buffalo. You gave me a great gift, and I'll give you one. I'm the guide to the sacred mountains. Walk under me. Walk under me, and the eagles won't see you. Or at least, if they do see you. Don't be afraid. Don't let your fear or anger blind you. Eagles don't mess with buffalo. And so they head toward the sacred mountain. They have to stop and rest a lot, because Jumping Mouse had these little lungs. And one time when they're resting, the buffalo surprised them by saying, I have to leave you now. I can't climb these steep foothills. But don't let your fear or anger blind you. And the buffalo left. And Jumping Mouse was all alone. And those spots seemed more numerous and bigger, probably closer. What did they tell me? Don't let your fear or anger blind you? Sure, easy to say. So he continued on his journey, and eventually, climbing up a really steep foothill, he came across a beautiful gray wolf, motionless, gawking into space like a frozen statue. That's a strange position, Jumping Mouse. And he worked his way around in front of the wolf, and he made some motions, but the wolf didn't see him. Hello, brother wolf, said Jumping Mouse. Wolf, wolf, wolf. Yes, that's what I am. I'm a wolf. Wolf, wolf. And the wolf's mind dimmed. And he struck that catatonic, mindless pose again, not moving, not speaking. Brother wolf, 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 wolf. Yes, that's what I am. I'm a wolf. I am a, wolf. Oh, not jumping now. A brain-damaged wolf. Brother wolf. Wolf, wolf, wolf. Yes, that's what I am. I'm a wolf. I'm a... Shut up, said Jumping Mouse. I know you're a wolf, and you're touched in the head. And I know what'll cure you. It's the eye of a mouse. And I am a mouse. And if it will cure you, you may have my eye. No sooner had Jumping Mouse said that than his eye flew out of his head into the wolf, and the wolf became whole and sane. This wolf didn't walk around. This wolf began to dance. This wolf did backflips and handstands and somersaults. And then he remembered the mouse, and he stopped and stood motionless right in front of Jumping Mouse, with great big tears of gratitude flowing down his cheeks. But Jumping Mouse didn't see the tears. For now, he was blind. Thank you. Thank you for restoring me to sanity. What are you doing out here? Well, I've seen the sacred mountains, and I want to go there. Good, said the wolf. I'm the guide to the top of the sacred mountains. Follow me, and we'll get there. We'll climb together. Oh, it was hard. Jumping Mouse had to stop off and to rest. And just when he thought he couldn't go any further, his lungs were on fire, and he was going to tell the wolf that he had to quit, but just then he felt something brush his cheek. Did you feel that? Said the wolf. Yeah, what was that? That, my little friend, is a breeze off the beautiful Medicine Lake on top of the sacred mountains. We're almost there. We're almost there. Just when Little Mouse thought he was dying, he's almost to the top of the sacred mountain. Hang on to my tail and I'll drag you to the top. And so eventually they get to the top of the sacred mountains, and they sit on the edge of the beautiful Medicine Lake while the wolf describes the beauty of the wildflowers in the meadow and evergreens and big puffy white cumulus clouds marching across the blue sky. And then Jumping Mouse heard a familiar voice. Not the wolf's, but another, and a familiar voice. Hello, little brother, said that voice. Hello, said Jumping Mouse. Who's there? It's I, Brother Frog. I'm the keeper of the Medicine Lake on top of the river. You're a great boss. You've come so far. You haven't let your fear or anger blind you. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. Would you like some medicine power? Yes. Medicine power for me? Not jumping off? Yes. Then crouch as low as you can, and jump as high as you can, and when you do, you will have medicine power. Jumping Mouse crouched as low as he could. He just hugged the top of that mountain, and he flung himself skyward, and when he did, the wind caught him, and he's tumbling through space, and a jet stream catches him and blows him, just hurtles him upward. And instinctively, to stabilize himself, he puts out all four paws, and then the wind really catches him and just flips him through the sky, higher and higher. Out of control. In space. Where nothing is familiar. And then he hears another sound, a voice. Blue, 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 green, green, blue, green. He's beginning to see color. That must be the Medicine Lake, surrounded by the evergreen tree. And the higher he goes, the clearer his vision becomes. He goes so high that he can see the fish in the lake. He can distinguish one wildflower from another. He goes higher and he can count the petals on the wildflower. And there, on the edge of the beautiful Medicine Lake, is that silly old frog smiling up at him. And next to him, a wolf smiling up at him. And out there on the prairie, a buffalo smiling up at him. Have you ever heard a buffalo smile or seen a buffalo smile? Oh, it's a thing to behold. And then further out by the river, there's a raccoon smiling up at him. And the raccoon and the buffalo and the wolf and the frog all cry out to Jumping Mouse, smiling at Jumping Mouse and crying out to him. And you have a new name. You are an eagle. I beg of you not to say anything after you share the story. Wait for people to comment on their understanding. Sometimes it'll be confusion, but that's okay. Their interpretations, their feelings, some of their feelings will be resentment and revenge for having told you such a dumb story and taken up so much of their time. But encourage them to keep talking, and you'll be amazed at what happens. A little mouse jumps pretty good. Jumping Mouse might visit you in the middle of the night with some new insights. It happens often. I left part of the story out. You can put it in depending on the audience. When Jumping Mouse is on top of the Sacred Mountains, blind with the wolf announces, I must leave you now. I have to guide others. Call me if you need me. Left, and Jumping Mouse was alone. Alone, all alone on top of the Sacred Mountains. And then he felt a shadow cross his back. And another. And another. And then he heard the sound that eagles make. And the eagle hit. And Jumping Mouse went to sleep. And then he woke up. The surprise of being alive was wonderful. More wonderful than anything he ever knew before. So now you met my friend Jumping Mouse. He's yours. 15 years with gratitude. Thank you, God, for all you've given me. Thank you, God, for all you've taken from me. Thank you, God, for all you have left me. I continually wish blessings upon the men who make these retreats. My special blessing to all of you. May you find joy in your heart, peace in your soul, love in your life.